we've been talking about emotions, feelings, and the conclusion we came to was that the Torah lays out what feelings we should have and what feelings we shouldn't have in detail. There are specific rules, and that's all we have. We just have those rules, and we have to try to follow them as best we can. Now, what I would like to do today is just review for you a few of the rules, and then we'll talk about how one can do this, how one can work on one's emotions, one's feelings. It's just to get an idea of what kinds of responsibilities there are. First of all, with respect to Hashem, we have two. One is we're supposed to love Hashem, which is an emotion. And also, we're supposed to fear Hashem and have awe for Hashem. We'll have to talk about each of these and also about how we can put them together, because it could seem that maybe each one is possible by itself, but putting the two together could cause a special problem. We'll have to talk about that. Then, we have a responsibility to love other Jews. And it's interesting, it's only responsibility to love other Jews. There's no responsibility to love non-Jews. One might, and it might even be appropriate, might be correct thing to do, but it's not required. It's not an obligation to do so. There's a special mitzvah to love one subcategory of Jews. Which one?
Converts.
I have to miss a gear. Interestingly, there is no, maybe we should keep this a secret and not spread it too widely, but there is no special mitzvah to love your parents. Pah! How about that? The things you might learn in yeshiva. And there's no special mitzvah to love your children or your neighbors. The only special subcategory of Jews that you have a special mitzvah to love is gerim. Converts. Then, we're supposed to hate evil, and in some respect, to some extent, hate evil doers, people who do evil. Umusanecha esna, says David HaMelech, I hate those who hate you. Speaking to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, I hate those who hate you. Then, there is a mitzvah of v'samachta v'chagecha. On a chag, a holiday, you're supposed to rejoice. That's just on the time of the chag. And then, every mitzvah should be done with simcha, if du es Hashem v'simcha. We are forbidden, don't hate your friend in your heart. We spoke already about the fact that you could love and hate at the same time, right? There's such a thing as a love-hate relationship. So when the Torah tells us, love your fellow Jew, that doesn't exclude hate. You could love him and hate him. So the Torah has another mitzvah. Don't hate your brother in your heart. But here, it's limited to your brother. If he steps out of those guidelines of brother, then it might be appropriate to hate him. But it might be appropriate to love him also. both simultaneously. Anyway, we'll come to that in a minute. So you have here a whole bunch of rules which tell you things you're supposed to feel. Just as a footnote, an emotion is not just a feeling. There's more to an emotion than a feeling. But it includes feeling. I'm concerned about the feeling part of it now. We did a study of emotions. There's a lot more to an emotion than just a feeling. But it does include feeling. Now, let's start with a general question. What do you mean, a rule how to feel? No, feeling isn't something I choose. I don't choose to feel one way or the other way. It just happens. Gosh, you look down today. Yeah, I'm down. That's where I am. Just, you know, I don't feel good today. Or, boy, you look excited today. Yeah, I'm full of enthusiasm. I'm full of inspiration. Just, you know, it's a good day. What do you mean there are rules that I have to follow how I should feel? How can there be a rule how to feel? How is that realistic? What can I do about it? I said, no, don't feel like that. Feel different. Thanks very much. Well, what am I supposed to do about it? Now, here's a case where when the question is asked, you get that queasy feeling in your stomach, oh my gosh, something's really wrong here. And the truth is, every one of you knows the answer to this question. And every one of you has used it. And every one of you has practiced it. You're all aware of this. But when I ask the question like this, you don't make connection with your own experience. This is what the philosophy does to people, you know. It sort of makes people spin. Makes the head spin. And you forget where you've been and what you do. Anybody think of a practical example where you want to change your feelings, so you do something and you succeed in changing your feelings?
Maybe if you're not usually inclined to go after a girl because you're usually more relaxed, and you can change your character and be like, oh, my God, I'm just... on every girl, or just change up the situation to meet what it is. Like, if you're not willing, maybe to hunt or something, you'll like to hunt, but it's like you just push your effort to learn how to hunt. Maybe you cross your threshold.
You hate something and you realize that there's no reason to hate it, so you commit. Once you commit yourself, that there's no reason for you to hate it. That it's like, for example, if you hate working. So if you convince yourself that, oh, well, I'll be happy if I work, so then I don't hate to work anymore. I start enjoying the work.
Okay, so this is close to what we said the other day, that if you focus on certain facts that you didn't take into account before, you could change your attitude, because it's usually the facts about the thing that make you feel the way you do. And if you learn other facts, or focus mentally on other facts, so then... let me share an experience with you. An experience that my father, Oliver Shalom, put me through, and I trusted him at the time, which was not difficult for me. I didn't usually trust anybody. And I gained a tremendous amount from it. When I was a kid, I was in the Scouts, and in the group that I was in, the father who was in charge of the group put his kid above others. Against the rules. Against, this kid wasn't qualified. He put him up in a higher position, and we all had to listen to him. So I said to my father, you know, this is against the rules. It's unjust. And the kid is incompetent. So I don't want to do this. And my father said, if you want to move to another group, I'll move you. You're right. You're absolutely right. But I'm telling you, he said, I'm telling you it's worth your while to stick it out to the end of the year, which is, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And he said to me, I can't tell you why. I can't tell you why, but this will be worthwhile. This will be important for you. Nope. I don't know, something about the way he said it, and I trusted him, and I stuck it out for the end of the year. And as I grew up, as I went through life, I saw that life has in it plenty of injustice, plenty of wrong. And sometimes, if you want to get to your goal, you have to put up with it. Even though it's unjust, wrong, unfair, nasty, vicious, you have to put up with it. And if you're the kind of person who says, but it's unfair, and you go to pieces, you're right, it is unfair. But you're going to go to pieces, then you're not going to get what you want. I have a PhD. I would say anybody who gets a PhD has had dirt shoveled on him, one place or another. Because they take advantage of graduate students and professors are arbitrary. I had a friend who was almost finished with his thesis. One of the directors of his thesis left the university. Somebody else came on, joined his committee, and said, I don't like half your thesis. Do it over.
Oh,
God. It cost him a year. It cost him a whole year to get his PhD. It was delayed a whole year. Was that fair to him? He was working under another professor. The other professor said it's good material. This guy doesn't like it. Wouldn't it have been reasonable for the new guy to say, listen, you worked for 3 years under these other people, and they approved it. So, good, you know, well, who am I to come in at the last minute? No, I don't like it. Do it over. Now, if he had been the kind of person who says, it's unfair, it's unjust, I'm not playing ball, he would have been 100% right, but he wouldn't have his PhD. He'd have lost it. I saw many people in PhD programs, only 25% of the people who start finish. 75% don't make it. 3/4 don't make it. It's a tremendous waste of time, effort, and money. Too bad. They just don't make it. Some of them don't make it because they can't put up with it. Now, the goal, the difference here is looking at the present and looking at the future. Similar to what he said. If you say, I know it hurts, and it's wrong, they're taking advantage of me, they're victimizing me. And a doctor, the person who becomes a doctor, he's got to go through 2 years of internship. In internship, you work 48 hours straight. 48, you ever heard of a job where you work 48 hours straight? It's against the rules, right? No union will put up with that. Every union except the doctor's union. They're proud of it. For 2 years, this guy works 48 hours straight and he's paid next to nothing. Interns are paid next to nothing. It's slave labor. They get a lot of tremendous free work out of these guys. That's your badge for becoming a doctor. I went through internship. But it's crazy, right? It's all right. If you can't put up with that, then you're not going to be a doctor. That's all. Go wash test tubes someplace. You're not going to be a doctor. So here, my father, Olor Shon, put me through this experience to enable me, in the midst of the pain, to put my mind on the end and say, yes, it is painful, but it's worth it. If you focus on the fact that it's worth it, if you focus on the fact that what you're going to get out of it, then you can put up with it. If you can't focus on that, the pain overwhelms you and you just collapse. So here's the question of mental focus. That's a good example of how you can change how you feel. In this case, it doesn't, maybe in my case, a little less dramatic than yours. It's not becoming pleasurable, but the pain can be bearable. Whereas if you don't have that other focus, the pain can be unbearable. Yeah.
Does it really change how you feel, or just changes how you react?
If it didn't change how you felt, it wouldn't change how you react.
Okay.
And another way to do it is like in a relationship when you're not going well. If you do something for someone, you always change how you feel.
Okay. That's a fairly dramatic example, but you're putting your finger on a whole category. What you do can change how you feel. And whereas it's almost impossible just to decide how to feel, you can decide what to do, and by doing something, you could change how you feel. Let's take simple examples. A person says, I feel so down, I'm going to put on this piece of music, because this piece of music cheers me up. Doesn't music have an effect on how you feel? So all you have to do is press the button. Press the button, you hear the music, and all of a sudden you feel it's changed.
Just smile.
Another thing, if you smile, this is a tremendous experiment, you can try this. Just walk outside. First of all, if you say hello with a smile, they'll lock you up. Not in this country, Yeah, but okay, so, maybe in Yeshiva where the Americans, they won't lock you up. Right? What happens is this. If you smile, the other person smiles back. And when the other person smiles back, you feel good. Because he smiled at you. So if you smile, you can make yourself feel good because by you smiling, you cause the other person to smile. And his smile back makes you feel good. A person who's very angry and very frustrated and very upset, one way to at least reduce the feeling is to work out. Because when you're physically exhausted, you don't feel that kind of traumatic, powerful emotion. It takes physical strength to feel that emotion. And if you go out and run 4 or 5 miles, you won't feel as bad anymore. Just because you're... They used to say, I'm so angry, I'm going to go chop wood. Right? It doesn't mean, I'm so angry, I've got lots of energy. Now's a good time to lay up wood for the winter. That's not what it means. What it means is, I'll chop wood, I'll be exhausted, and I won't feel so angry. How about people? Sometimes a person says, I'm so nervous, and I'm so worried, if I'll pick up the phone and talk to so-and-so, I'll feel better. Because I always feel better when I talk to so-and-so. So-and-so calms me down. So-and-so knows the right things to say. So by dialing a number on the telephone and having a conversation, you can change how you feel. We all have ways to change how we feel, and we use them naturally. We use them as part of our everyday wisdom of how to live in the world. It's part of how to change our feelings. Let's say you're going to throw a party. No, and you're inviting your friends. You have to make a lot of decisions. What time, day or night? What kind of food and drink to serve? And how to tell them to dress? What mix of friends to invite? Where to have it? Indoors, outdoors, high lighting, low lighting, music in the background, and no music in the background, and if music, what kind of music? All that will determine the mood of the party. Will it be relaxed and calm and sort of trivial, or will it be intense, or will it be boisterous and exciting? You can create those emotions, and you'll feel them also in the midst of the party. So we are not helpless with respect to our emotions. We have lots of techniques that we can use to stimulate, to create or destroy or change the emotions that we have. What we need to do is look for the particular rules and see what means are available for each particular rule to make that rule work in terms of our emotions. Here's one general rule that works for a lot of cases. Let's say you have HDTV, and you have a screen that's 3 feet by 3 feet. You've got one of these home entertainment centers, you know, it's worth $14 billion, I don't know. And you've got speakers all over the room. And you're watching the Super Bowl. And you got instant replay, you know, they got 3 different screens going at the same time and everything else. There are people with all of that who will pay $250 for a ticket and go to the game. Now, why would they do that? Why would they do that? I mean, what they see on the field is not going to be nearly as good as what they'll see at home in their home entertainment center. What's the point of going to the field? I know they carry on their pocket TV and they watch TV at the field. You know what? I'll tell you one of the reasons. One of the reasons is this. When a goal is scored and 75,000 people leap to their feet and cheer, it's not the same as hearing it home with quadraphonic sound. The feeling isn't the same. Because you are together with 75,000 cheering people. And emotions are contagious. You feel the emotions of the people around you. When a lot of people are together and they're all feeling and expressing an emotion, your feeling is going to be much, much greater than anything you could imagine, anything you could manage at home, even if at home you have the best entertainment center, but you're not together with those people. If you want to stimulate certain emotions, one very powerful way to do it is hang around people who have those emotions and show them. Lechadoidi Friday night. If you're among a group of people who sing Lechadoidi and sing it with enthusiasm, and then, dare I say this in yeshiva, dance afterwards. Yeah. Dance around with the Lechadoidi, you know. You will feel differently about Shabbos than if you're with a group of people who mumble and go home. Because you share the emotion with other people. If you are in the presence of someone who makes Kiddush, who really makes Kiddush, who sanctifies the day, first of all, you'll feel something when he makes Kiddush, and from then on, it'll change the way you make Kiddush. Your Kiddush will mean something different. Because his emotion rubs off. You take it in. becomes part of your experience. And this is true with any experience. You know what the Daf Yomi is. The daily Daf of the Gemara. Every day of the year, a Daf of the Gemara goes by. You do that, you finish the Gemara, the Talmud Bavli, in 7 1/3 years. When they finish, there are worldwide celebrations. We're about 2.5 years from one now. 5 years ago, I was in New York. Madison Square Garden was packed with 40,000 Jews. The Felt Forum was packed with another 5,000 Jews. Nassau Coliseum, where I was, had 17,000 Jews. The Yidav and Meir was 17,000 Jews. Sephoroch was 17,000 Jews. Yesh Mei Rabu was 17,000 Jews. That's a Meir you don't forget. You stand there and say Tilm. And on one screen, you have Madison Square Garden. Another screen, you have Melbourne, Australia. And all the Jews are saying Tilm together. You can see their mouths mouthing the same words. All linked by satellite. That's an experience. And you don't forget it. And it communicates a feeling at the time, and it has a carryover, not at the same intensity. We talked about time, making things get smaller, but still, it has a carryover. The Torah says, 3 times a year, everybody's supposed to come up to Yerushalayim. For Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. That's not trivial. They didn't come up by an egged bus. They walked, they rode on donkeys, in carts. Could take a week to get here, a week to go home, sleeping on the road. And as someone in Chicago pointed out to me years ago, I forget who it was, he stopped me on the street and said, did you ever think about this? He said, Sukkos, you have to go to Yerushalayim for Sukkos. Let's say you're coming from Tzfas. Could take a week to get there. So where do you spend Rosh Hashanah? On the road, sleeping in a field someplace. Where do you spend Yom Kippur? Not at home with your friends, with your chazan, ha, the guy with that great tenor voice. No, you're somewhere in the, you know, in the sticks, running around. And you come to this place, okay, we'll spend Yom Kippur here, and tomorrow night we'll go on to the next place. And over here is where you spend Yom Kippur with a group of strangers, so you have to come together and sort of get to know and work it. What kind of Yom Tov is that? What kind of Rosh Hashanah is that? What kind of, you know, where's my apple and honey, you know, and all that kind of stuff. That's it. What for? So you come to Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim there are hundreds of thousands of Jews. And they're all davening together. And they're all bringing korbanos together. Barob am ha'tesmelech, when there's a great multitude of Jews together serving the Kodesh Baruch Hu, the glory and the beauty of the king is felt. When you don't feel it at other times. That's the great thing about the Siyum HaShas. You get a little glimpse of that. A little glimpse of that feeling. When you have 40,000 Jews together, all of a sudden. By the way, there was a reporter there at Madison Square Garden, if I remember correctly, a reporter of the New York Times, who was a Muslim. That's the Times. And one thing he wrote in his column was, he bets this is the only time when there was a public event in Madison Square Garden where it was dead silent. When they stood at the station on Esrei, it was dead silent. You could hear a pin drop. 40,000 people, silence in Madison Square Garden. You know the shtuyot that goes on in that place. The absolute nonsense, waste of time, degradation that goes on in that place. Here you have 40,000 people praying to a Kodesh Baruch Hu in silence. It's like a different world. A privilege to have been there. I still carry in my Tzudat Zehut case, I carry the ticket to the Siyum HaShas. It was a precious, precious experience for me. Especially since I was finishing shots with everybody else. So it wasn't just a... I recommend, when the next time comes around, in a few years, try to be there. Try to, it's an experience you will treasure. Something. Because, with that multitude of people all sharing it together, the emotion is just awesome. Absolutely awesome. Anyway, so associating with people who have these emotions is a way for you to pick up these emotions as well. Now, let's take Simcha on Yom Tovin. I didn't tell you this, but I'll just mention it now. Shabbos, there is no mitzvah of Simcha on Shabbos. The Torah says, "Samachta b'chagecha." You should have simcha on your holidays, but that doesn't include Shabbos.
But oneg Shabbos, doesn't it imply?
That oneg is physical pleasure. That's a different category altogether. Maybe we'll talk about physical pleasure tonight, and I'll forget to tonight. We're talking about joy, right? Nevertheless, as you all know, in the Zmiros of Shabbos, Luchovet, simcha. So how come? If there's no mitzvah of simcha on Shabbos, how can we sing about simcha the whole day long? Every one of the Zmiros talks about simcha on Shabbos. I'll tell you a beautiful vort by the Teretz Niemann. It's really the Hasidic vort, even though he's probably turning in his... I should call him a chassid, but we take control of everybody. You know, if he's good, he's a chassid, for sure. Yeah. No, no, we. You know, the real people, the ones with the funny black hats. This is what he says. The Torah says, make silver trumpets and blow them. There's a whole list of times when to blow. One of the times to blow is, Uviyom Simchascha, the day of your simcha. Says the Gemara, Elo Shabbosos. These are Shabbosos. Aye, but there's no mitzvah of simcha on Shabbos. So how could the Gemara say that the time of simcha that the Torah is talking about is the time of Shabbos, since there's no mitzvah? Says the Torah to Mima, on Shabbos, simcha is not a mitzvah, not an obligation, not a rule, not a duty. It's just a fact. It's a fact. It's a raw fact. Because when the Kodesh Baruch Hu finished creating the universe, he had simcha, so the Medrash says. He celebrated the fact that the universe was created. That means above there is simcha. And any Jew who's connected to what's going on above naturally feels simcha on Shabbos. All you have to do is open yourself up. All you have to do is make yourself aware. You don't have to produce the simcha. On Yom Tov, you have to produce it. You have an obligation to make it. Here, you don't have to produce it. It's in the air. My analogy is this. I don't know if you've ever done this, but it's really quite interesting to do. Take two strings and tune them to the same pitch. Pluck one. The other one will vibrate. All by itself. Without touching it. If you pluck one and then put your finger on it to stop it, you'll hear the other one humming. As long as they're close to one another. Now, if you don't have two strings, I'll tell you how to do this on a piano. Because you can do it one octave above. It also works one octave above. So here's what you do. Take a C. Any note, really. And press down the key very gently. So that the hammer doesn't hit the string, but the damper comes off. So the string is open, but you didn't hit it. You didn't make any sound. Just press the key down very gently and hold it down. One octave below, hit the key very sharp, very fast to let go. Just bang, like that. Sorry for the tapes. Just bang, like that. And the one you're holding down, the octave above, if you listen, you'll hear it humming. Even though you didn't touch it. That's called overtones, but it's the same idea. In the lower one, you have a whole bunch of tones, not just one. And one of the overtone, first overtone, which is an octave above, is the same as the one you're holding down, and it makes it hum. This is what's called sympathetic vibrations. That's the way it's called in physics. Sympathetic vibrations. Because they're tuned to the same pitch. If one vibrates, the other will vibrate. Now, I say, if your soul is tuned to the same pitch as what's going on above, when above you're there's vibrating, below there'll be vibrating. All you have to do is tune your soul to the right pitch. You don't have to hit it. You don't have to strike it or pluck it to make it vibrate. It'll vibrate because it's vibrating above. That's the idea of simcha on Shabbos. Now, as one Talmud asked me many years ago, Rabbi, you're telling me I'm supposed to feel simcha on Shabbos. You know, he says, Shabbos comes on the clock. It's just every week on the clock. But let's imagine now. You know, it's 3 minutes before sundown, Friday afternoon. 3 minutes to simcha. Counting down. 2 minutes, 1 minute, you know. 10 seconds, 9 seconds, 8 seconds, 2, 1, simcha! Can you really put simcha on a clock? He says, okay, you know, I can set an alarm. That'll make it easy, right? And then when the alarm goes off, that's when you're supposed to feel happy. Can you really time Simcha 2 o'clock. And nevertheless, if you go to families and watch them on Shabbos, you can see the Simcha. So how do they do it? It's not magic. If you take Shabbos, as you know, and you're not going to do any work on Shabbos, and you're going to spend Shabbos with your friends and your family, and on Shabbos you're going to have wonderful meals with the best food and the best drinking, you put on your best clothes, and you're going to daven and sing during the davening, and you'll have some Torah study, the day is relaxed, why shouldn't you be happy? You've created for yourself a little piece of Gan Eden, a little piece of the Garden of Eden. So why shouldn't you be happy? And why shouldn't you look forward to it? TGIF. Hang in there. Shabbos is coming. People really feel that way. Why? Because Shabbos really is a piece of heaven on earth. So it's not shocking that people feel happy and feel joyful on Shabbos. Because the Torah has designed for us a day which naturally makes you feel that way. Yeah.
A couple of us are lost. What's TGIF? Oh, okay.
Thank God it's Friday.
The first ones that are lost on that one.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. So, here again, you're controlling the environment, setting up a certain environment, and you're going to perform certain activities, and they're going to affect how you feel. Lo sisna sachich telavavecha hokeach tochiach hamisecha. Don't hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely... Okay, the polite word is reprove. The real thing is ball him out. You shall surely ball him out, criticize him. Don't hate him in your heart. You shall surely criticize him and tell him off. Now, the Torah puts those two things back to back. The Torah means to say that one is related to the other. What relationship is there between don't hate your brother in your heart on this hand, and you shall surely reprove him, criticize him, ball him out on the other hand? So I think that, at least in part, it works like this. First of all, don't hate my brother in my heart. What are we talking about? Somebody who, you know, crossed me or disappointed me in some way? We're talking about even legitimate hate, where the person has done something wrong. The person has done something wrong, the Torah says, don't hate him in your heart. You should rather reprove him, criticize him, ball him out. So here's the thing. I watch Reuven, and I see him do something really nasty. Psh, boy, really nasty. But the Torah tells me, don't hate him in your heart. Go to him, confront him. So I go to Reuven and say, Reuven, why did you do that? How could you have done that? You know, that's really nasty, Reuven. What's the matter with you? I mean, that's not the way you're supposed to do it. Okay, you're supposed to be kind and friendly and so on. But anyway, now suppose Reuven says, oh, that's what you think I did? You make a mistake. That's not what I did. You don't know the circumstances. You saw me shoot him in cold blood, didn't you? But you didn't see that he pulled a knife, did you? You didn't see that he pulled a knife. He was trying to stab me. That's why I shot him. No, if he explains that he didn't do what you thought, are you going to hate him? Not if you're normal. I thought he killed him in cold blood. Now I see that he was doing it in self-defense. Why should I hate him? Reuven, I saw you eating that cheeseburger. How could you do that? Standing right outside of McDonald's and you're eating a cheeseburger. What a horrible thing to do. He says, oh, you make a big mistake. I bought it at McDonald's. Down the street I bought a McDonald's and I happened to be eating it over here in front of McDonald's. It wasn't a cheeseburger at all. It was perfectly kosher.
What if, let's say, hypothetically, you make a new friend, not someone that you've known for a long time, and you assume that he does keep kosher, but you do see him eating a cheeseburger, so you go and confront him, and he says, yeah, I'm up the door, I'm eating a cheeseburger.
One second, I'm coming. This is only one. I have four responses. I'm going to go through four responses. But if the first response is that you don't know, you didn't appreciate what I was doing because you didn't have all the facts, that's going to cancel the hate automatically, right? You're not going to hate it. Now, second response, he says, you're right. I'm glad you pointed out. Oh, I slipped. I shouldn't have done that. Terrible. Okay, I agree with you. I'm not going to do it again. I'll make amends. I'll fix it up. Suppose he says that. Are you going to hate him? Probably not, right? I mean, he's admitting it, agreeing with you, and he's going to make it up again. He's not going to do it again. There's no reason to hate him. Third response, he says, you're right. It's a mistake. It's a crime. I want you to know I regret it, but I feel that I'm out of control. And I'm trying to stop it. I'm getting counseling, and I'm working on it, but I'm out of control. And I appreciate you telling me. And if you see me do it again, tell me again. It's important for you to help me to realize that what I'm doing is wrong. So I'm just telling you, you might see me do it again, but you realize I'm doing it because I'm out of control and I can't help it. If you get that response, are you going to hate him? Probably not. Right? So now we got three. You go to the guy and say, how did you do that crime? I have three possible responses, and for all three, you won't hate him. Of course, if he says, listen, get lost. This is what I do. I don't care if it's right or wrong. You know, jump off the Brooklyn Bridge. Don't talk to me about how to live. Then you might hate him, but then it might be right to hate him. Then it might be okay to hate him. Right? But by going to him and confronting him, you have created all sorts of opportunities to avoid the hate by getting a response that will take away the hate.
If one time it is hate, but 3 out of 4 you save it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You're opening up a very broad subject and a very important subject. Let me give you one or two sentences, but I can't do justice to it just as an answer right now, but this is really very important. Halacha is not as narrow as you seem to think. If there's anything really wrong with doing something, the halacha somewhere is going to tell you that it's wrong. You can't outrun halacha so easily. Now, for example, one thing about litter is other people don't like it. So by littering, you're causing other people discomfort. The halacha says you're not allowed to cause other people discomfort. So already it's a matter of halacha. It also could spread disease. And if it spreads disease, you're endangering other people. And the halacha says you're not allowed to endanger other people. So don't have too narrow an idea of how far halacha goes. Halacha goes very, very far. And if you could imagine a case that really outran all possible halacha, then we would say there's nothing really wrong in it. Because the halacha is supposed to define for us all the things that we should care about. Just don't think the halacha has only got to do with, you know, how you slaughtered the chicken. Halacha has to do with all aspects of life, really. Yeah.
What happens if you get a reason? Like, hate seems more definite than, like, you're coming up confused. So if you leave them, nothing really much comes of it. You know, it goes from hate to, like, you know.
Well, okay, that's a step forward. If it isn't full-fledged hate and it just becomes confusion, that's a step forward. Definitely an improvement. Yeah.
How do you feel a person hating what he does the same thing?
Not at all.
So is this you're supposed to hate him, actually?
So there's actually a machlokes about that. Some say yes and some say no. It's a big subject. Whether you're ever supposed to hate a Jew or whether you only hate what he does. And there's some say yes and some say no. It's a complicated... I'm not going to go into that in detail now. Yeah. Yes. This is another thing. Oh, this is an important point also, but I'm trying to stay within one subject. There are certain things which you're not supposed to feel, but you may pretend to feel them, or pretend to act as if you feel them, that you may do. Anger, like the Rambam says, you should never feel anger. That you should never feel anger, according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides. But, what?
There's no benefit to anger?
Feeling anger? That's what he would say. This is what he says. In Hilchos Deos, he says, you should not feel anger. But, there may be times when it's appropriate to act angry. That's right.
But when you feel angry, like, you have more energy, you can do more things, it's not beneficial at all to be angry. Maybe you'll think of something different, you'll come to, like...
I'm just telling you what the Rambam says. The Rambam says anger is absolutely forbidden. Feeling anger is absolutely forbidden. It's a whole subject. I mean, once I get started on that, I'm not going to be able to do anything else.
Yeah.
The one thing that's appropriate to be disappointed about is your own performance. I may slip on this, so I'm just telling you because I discovered that my feeling about it is correct, but I don't know if my habits have been brought into line. We often, when something happens that we don't like, you know, speaking to somebody else, we say, well, unfortunately, such and such happened, and we go on. Now, what does that mean, unfortunately? It means it happened because of bad fortune. Did, huh? Right. Just an accident. Bad fortune? Is fortune a name for another god? See, something's happened due to the Creator, and something's happened due to fortune. And, you know, it just depends on this. They divide up the world among them. God and fortune. You know, maybe there's good fortune and bad fortune, so there are three. There's God and good fortune and bad fortune, and they all run the world sort of, you know, in committee or in taking turns. This is absolute nonsense. This is nonsense. There is only one God, and He's running everything. So what do I mean, unfortunately? The word is just, you know, soap-suds thinking. It's just, you know, this occurred to me, and then somebody found me a ride to it in the Shulchan Aruch, which I've forgotten already, and I realize now that's not the appropriate thing to say, unfortunately. But disappointment, I can be disappointed in my own performance, yes.
You can be disappointed, like, disappointing, I don't know.
What's that?
He was disappointing. That was a disappointing thing, that was untimely.
Again, so that's it, you know, well, if something outside of me disappoints me, right? So then, it means, it's like saying it was unfortunate that it happened. Why did it happen? Why did it happen to me? How come I'm related to it? Because the Kodesh Baruch was running the world, organized that it should happen that way. No, if so, why should I be disappointed? So you remember what disappointed means? It could, you know, a person, if I expect something that I want and it doesn't happen, I may feel bad, but disappointed means a little more than that. Disappointment means something like, it should have happened. Look, I can't get out of this. Let's take anger. Think for a moment. I said to you at the beginning of the hour, this is one of the things I was trying to avoid. An emotion is not just a feeling. Emotions often have in them thoughts. It's a thought wrapped up in a feeling. It's a thought that leads to a feeling. Anger. Something happens and I say, wow, that makes me angry. Okay, so the anger is a feeling. What thought is behind that feeling? We're not talking about pain now. We're not talking about disappointment for the moment anyway. We're not talking about worry. We're talking about anger. What makes anger different from stomp pain? I think there's a thought in anger, and the thought is, it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have happened. It was wrong to have happened.
Or it should have.
But then I won't be angry. If it should have happened, why should I be angry? If I know, if a person says, let's see where this will fall. And it lands on his foot. He could be angry at his stupidity, but he isn't angry that it lands on his foot. He let it go onto his foot. Right? In other words, once you know how the thing happened, why it happened, and there's a good reason for it to happen, then the anger dissipates. The anger dissipates. A parent punishes a child. And the child says, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. And the child is very angry. And the parent says, yesterday, you did hide my car keys, didn't you? And it cost me a half hour late for my appointment, wasn't I? Well, now you're getting it. I think the child will be much less angry. Okay, right, that's true. I did do that. So I guess I deserved it. And a lot of the anger is going to dissipate. Because I now know it was right to happen, not that it was wrong to happen. Anger carries with it a thought that shouldn't have happened. It's not just that I'm being hurt. I'm being hurt the way that shouldn't have happened. What do you mean it shouldn't have happened? What do you mean it shouldn't have happened? Who's running the world anyhow? If because Baruch was running the world, then the idea that it shouldn't have happened is an incompetent thought. It's a wrong thought. It's like saying, unfortunately. This is one of the dangers in anger. The danger in anger, to a certain extent, is a kind of philosophical danger. that the thought that goes with it can lead you down to a long, wrong way of looking at the world. Anyway, what I wanted to talk to you about was how to stimulate these feelings. And we talked about a few. Let me talk about the last one for today. We're supposed to feel awe for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, we said one way to feel something is to think about facts. Think about the facts that are relevant. I think that awe for HaKadosh Baruch Hu is reasonably easy to achieve. Just think about simply what we know about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the simplest things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the universe. He made it out of nothing. He made it by just a simple desire. Let there be a universe, and bang, it was a universe. I have a recommendation. You try that for a teaspoon of sugar. Just sit there and say, let there be sugar. Try it. See how far you get. How about for a single grain of sugar? I'll make it easy for you. Or a fly. Or a pencil. Nothing very sophisticated. You know, we can't make anything that way. Not a mote of dust. Let there be dust. Come on. Just one. I'm not asking for much. Just, you know, one little piece of dust. Now, this universe has in it something like 10 to the 22 stars. 10 to the 22 means right of one, and then follow it with 22 zeros. That's a lot. Lots and lots and lots and lots of stars. And there's both who said, let it be, and bang, there it was. That's pretty impressive. Yeah. I wouldn't want to be in a dark corner, in a dark alley. What would I do? Furthermore, sometimes when I want to play with computer scientists, I say to them, I want you to design a robot. Here's what I want the robot to do. Number one, it's got to be able to move around, has to be able to sense its environment, has to be able to do construction. Together with others of its own kind, hundreds working together, digging tunnels and building different underground rooms and big piles, all working together, division of labor, and it has to take energy out of the environment, it's got to burn something for fuel, and along the way, from time to time, each of these robots should make copies of itself so that when they break down, you know, the other ones to carry on the work. This is what I want you to do. Make such a robot, and I want the whole chip that runs the robot to be no bigger than the head of a pin. I think even Big Blue is going to have trouble with that. Even IBM is going to have trouble with that. Now that's an ant. Everything that I told you can be done by ants. And their heads are much smaller than the head of a pin. That's pretty impressive! There's Vogel created ants and programmed them. Some say that it's so small, the programming has to be done with molecules. And programmed to do all that in a way that we can't even imagine. And that's not a badger. That's not a hummingbird. Do you know what hummingbirds can do that no other bird can do? They can fly backwards. Try that. And it's not an orangutan. And it's certainly not a human being. So think of a HaKadosh Baruch Hu bringing this universe into existence simply by saying, let it be. That's overwhelmingly great. Now, you imagine standing in the presence of such a being that could do that, it's easy to feel awe. Just meditate on that for 10 seconds before you stand up and say Shema Esrei. This is the one I'm talking to. The one who made this whole universe simply by saying, let it be. I think it's not too difficult to feel the greatness of that being. That's what it means to feel all. Okay?